Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Practice Groups, was recorded on Monday, April 3, 2017, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call, as today we discuss the new book, All Falling Faiths, with author Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. I'm Dean Reuter, General Counsel, Vice President, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome a guest moderator and interviewer today, Danielle Sassoon. She's the Assistant U.S. Attorney in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York. We're joined, of course, as I mentioned at the outset, by our author, the book again, All Falling Faiths, Reflections on the Promise and Failure of the 1960s. It's out now by Encounter Books, available on Amazon and other online outlets, and also, of course, in bookstores, if you have one of those bookstores near you. We're going to proceed with a bit of an interview by Danielle Sassoon. That should run a half an hour or so, but as always, we'll be looking to the audience for your questions, so please do be thinking of your questions for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Danielle Sassoon, the floor is yours.
Judge Wilkinson, it's a privilege to join you and the Federal Society on this call to discuss your recent memoir, All Falling Faiths, Reflections on the Promise and Failure of the 1960s. You published your last book, Cosmic Constitutional Theory, in 2012. That was during the year that I clerked for you. And in this latest book, you shift gears from writing about constitutional theory to writing a memoir, which obviously is a much more personal genre. And here it's a book that delves into very intimate topics, including your upbringing and your college experience. What prompted the shift from writing about the law to taking up this particular project?
Well, it was a number of things. I think, first of all, I had thought that I left the 1960s behind. I thought it was all in the rearview mirror. And then in these last few years, I've seen one thing or another, just the atmosphere on college campuses and the what I thought was a disrespect for law from different sides and everything. And it seemed like too much of a replay of that very tumultuous decade. And so I wanted upcoming generations to understand what we've been through in the 1960s. And I didn't want younger folks and upcoming generations to have a repetition of our experience. And so I was concerned that people didn't really remember all the damage that the 1960s had inflicted on our society, and I thought to myself, my gosh, these 1960 tensions are going to persist in our society as long as our country claims nationhood. And I wonder too, and I'm worried about how much of this recurring rancor our beautiful country should sustain. And you talk about shifting gears, and I did that going into the memoir. Traditionally, I think too much of the approach to the 1960s has been just shouting, and it brings everybody to the barricades, and it's the kind of thing that if you bring up the 1960s, it has all the potential of spoiling a good dinner party. And I thought, well, you know, it's time maybe for a new approach. So I decided on a memoir framework of very, very personal, and as personal and intimate as I could make it. And I thought, well, maybe this would be a more persuasive approach than just sort of shouting, which is what we've had too much of about the 1960s already. And another part of it, I think, Danielle, is just purely personal. I didn't know much about my grandparents, and I knew almost nothing of my great-grandparents. And I didn't want that to happen to my children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, because not knowing anything about my ancestors, it's left me with an emptiness and hollowness in my own life. And so I didn't want my children and grandchildren to experience this emptiness that I had. And we so often see the names and dates on a family tree, but when you look at those names and dates, do you ever wonder what those people were actually like? And so I wanted to recall them. And so the memoir recalls times, the 1960s, which I often did not like at all, and which I think were just very bad for America. But it recalls also people whom I loved a great deal. And at any rate, it was a difficult emotional experience when you write a memoir. Some of the recall makes you smile, and a lot of times the recall is extremely painful, and sometimes you smile through tears. But it was just something I felt I had to do, and it was something for the sake of not only my family, but for the sake of our country, America, that I wanted to do. And that's how it all got started.
You mentioned that one goal of this book is for family members to learn about you and this current generation to learn about your experience in the 1960s. And one thing the reader learns in reading this book is that you have some nostalgia, but you also are approaching things from a conciliatory standpoint. Reading the book, you seem to be striving for nuance and to reach readers of different persuasions and to encourage moderation, debate, and engagement with different and sometimes conflicting ideas. How did that attitude towards civic engagement fall out of favor, in your view, and where should we start in trying to get it back?
Well, you're absolutely right. And part of the tone, as your question points out, that I try to strike is one that's conciliatory and moderate in some respects, because I only, I think in the long run, either we're going to make it in this country together or we're not going to make it at all. And there was so much in my time at Yale. There was so much sort of people grabbing each other by the throat, figuratively, and there was so much of poison and toxicity in the dialogue. And I thought, looking back on it now, much of that adversary relationship and much of that acrimony that existed on campus has tied it over into adulthood. I mean, the habits we picked up in our youth of acrimony are present with us now. And so I think that one way that one might return to a more conciliatory atmosphere is by changing the atmosphere on campus, which is now too much reminds me of my own youth. And the question you also ask is, how do we go about doing this? And, I don't have all the answers, and if I did, you wouldn't believe me, and you'd be right not to. But what I do think is that my memoir points out the questions that we need to ask. And the questions really trace back to what the 1960s, many of the things the 1960s took away from us. In my judgment, the 1960s did incalculable harm to the spirit of tolerance in higher education and to the basic stability of our family unit and to our respect for the rule of law and to our sense of America as home and to our capacity for national unity and to our need for the sustenance of faith. And so when you look at the 1960s and the damage it inflicted to different values and different institutions, then you get to know the questions, at least, about how do we get these things back, not in any retrogressive sense, but in a sense of providing a foundation for this beautiful country to go forward. And so I think I know the questions to ask, and I think I know the process that we should proceed along, which is much of which I've spent 32 years in the judiciary undergoing, and that is that you listen to both sides of an argument on the courts before you reach a decision, and we have conferences, and we listen to our colleagues with decidedly different views before we hand down a decision. And so there are difficulties in transplanting that process into the political process, but I do think it has some value in how we go about decision-making in this country. So whereas I, by a long shot, don't have all the answers, I do believe I know some of the questions that all of us need to ask about restoring a viable civic culture and a viable national foundation. And I do believe I know a little bit about the process, listening and exchanging views that we go about in answering these questions. So you're absolutely right, Danielle. It's a nuanced book. It tries to appreciate the other side of the 60s argument. I think on balance, it hurt us a great deal. There are other people who think it did a great deal of good. Fine. I respect them. And I hope that by the end of the book, not only will we appreciate the damage that was done, but that we'll appreciate the other side of the 1960s argument. And if I fail to do that, then I think that would be a significant shortcoming on my part. But I've certainly tried.
One of the chapters in your book, and you alluded to this already, is about the demise of the law and the damage to the rule of law done in the 60s. Can you describe what some of that damage was and also what role you think the law can and should play in restoring some of the damage that you think was done to this country during the 60s?
Well, I think a lot of the damage to the rule of law was done with this basic proposition that people during the 1960s felt they could take law into their own hands. The most terrible example were these badly demented people who assassinated John and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr., that they had some vision or thirst for notoriety or whatever it was that led them to disregard the law and just pursue whatever it is that they in their own individual distortion felt was right. And you saw many of the great urban riots in the 1960s, in the 64, 65, 66, in Detroit and Rochester and Watts and Harlem and They, I think, inflicted great damage not only on those communities and shopkeepers and law-abiding citizens who were there, but they, I think, inflicted a damage upon respect for laws as a whole. And then on the other side, the people that were enforced, they were supposed to enforce the law, the police departments, among others, who were supposed to enforce the law, went about disregarding the law in their own way. And you see those horrible examples of Bull Connor in Birmingham shooting those hoses and unleashing the dogs in 1963. And then in 1968, the Chicago Police Department is literally out of control at the 1968 Democratic Convention. And then later, you have the horrible events at Stonewall and near Greenwich Village in New York City, where a whole police department just visited cruelty upon people in that community. And then it was all capped off by Kent State and the just perfectly senseless slaughter of those four students by National Guardsmen on the campus. And so it was perfectly devastating because you had the assassinations, the riots, the police departments, all in their own way doing this damage and saying that, you know, we really don't need to abide by the constraints of law. And what was so horrible about it was, you know, that Martin Luther King Jr. and John and Robert Kennedy represented, you know, great hope for this country, and these were the people who were cut down. And along when they were shot, much of that hope went. My generation went with them. And I try to capture all this. Each chapter in my book tries to center around a certain figure. And in the chapter on the law, I take that figure to be the dean of my law school at the University of Virginia and show how he believed in the potentialities of law, and he used to express the ideal of law in the most inspirational imaginable way. And I thought that by the end of the decade, his grand vision of the law had been reduced to rubble by all of these different forces. A man who believes so deeply in the law, having his vision so scarred and destroyed. And we saw it, I think. Whether he recognized it is one of the mysteries that still remains unsolved. But a lot of how you restore respect for law is to simply restore a respect for civility, because when you ask someone to respect the law, you're asking somebody to respect outcomes that they don't necessarily agree with and that they may not like at all. And how do you get them then how do you get people to respect outcomes of legislative battles, of elections, of court decisions that they just don't like? And part of the answer has to be the tone that we set. It gives people the recognition that if they lose today, they can win tomorrow, and that gives people the understanding that, okay, we differ on this issue, but we still love you as our fellow Americans. And so often, I'm not pointing any fingers here, but so often both sides are not conveying the sort of mutual respect for one another that is absolutely necessary for the law to flourish and thrive. And you can disagree with somebody without disliking that person. It happens all the time on my court, where I think a spirit of great civility and mutual warmth still prevail. And Danielle, you were there, and you understand that, you know, some of the people that were my closest friends on the court were some of the people I disagreed with the most. And that's the way it should be. And that's too often not the way it is.
Absolutely. And one good thing to come out of the 60s was that you decided to dedicate your career to public service, and the country has benefited from that greatly. Reading the book, the reader learns that before your time as a federal judge, you had some forays into politics, including as the president of the Yale Political Union. What did that experience teach you about politics, and how did it affect your thinking about the issues you take up in the book?
Well, a lot of things. One of the things that I picked up from the Yale Political Union was I just learned to love debate, and it was just so much fun to join issues, you know, in a nice way, and I've always thought, you know, if you learn to love debate and you love to join issues with somebody, but you do so in the spirit of a happy warrior, the way Franklin Roosevelt did, the way Ronald Reagan did, but I just got this love for debating and exchanging. That's why one reason I became a teacher, because I could engage back and forth with my students about subjects we all cared about, but we could do so in a very cordial and collegial spirit. And it's one of the things I love about the court is I enjoy the debate with my colleagues, and I enjoy when really good, fine attorneys come before me. I just love the exchange of ideas, and I really like that. My experience in politics was brief, and really, to be honest, it wasn't very successful. I ran for Congress when I was 25, and running against a three-term incumbent, and the voters sent me back to law school, and that's fine. It was still a great experience. But I think that I was trying to think, where do I get this enjoyment of just, you know, happy and good-natured but still very principled debate? And I think I got that, a lot of it, from the Yale Political Union. I'm very grateful for the experience that I had there, and just the fun of being forced to come up with a response in an instant and still have it be intelligible, and not feeling awkward about being in front of other folks, and, you know, not replaying everything endlessly in your own mind by saying, oh, I should have said this, I should have said this. You just realize you go out and do the best you can. But I think a lot of that was instilled in me at the Political Union. It's where I just learned to love the very civil and good-natured battle of ideas.
Dean, at this point, we'd like to solicit any questions from the audience.
Very good. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
The floor mode is on. To request the floor, enter star, then pound.
So once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We're speaking with Danielle Sassoon and author and judge J. Harvey Wilkinson about his book, again, the title of the book, All Falling Faiths, Reflections on the Promise and Failure of the 1960s. It's available at Amazon, other online sites, and at bookstores near you. We begin today with two questions on the line, so let's go to our first caller.
Hello. Ernesto Sanchez from Miami, Florida here. Judge Wilkinson, we've met at some Federalist Society conferences. It's nice to hear from you. I was wondering to what extent you could attribute some of the trends that you discussed perhaps to the mistakes of not what you call the 60s generation, but perhaps what is popularly known as the World War II generation. And I'm thinking specifically, for example, of the example that you show in your book of the Reverend William Sloan Coffin, who perhaps personified the ideal of that generation to a great extent, had gone to Yale, had done his military service, had served in the Central Intelligence Agency, and then became a distinguished clergyman, but then became one of the many individuals who did encourage a lot of the problems, I suppose, that you criticize. And I think that there are many, many people, especially many distinguished alumni of Yale, and being an Ivy Leaguer myself, I'll say the same thing about my own alma mater. To what extent do you think that the destructive trends of the 60s can be traced to mistakes or changes of heart that happened on the part of the World War II generation?
Well, thank you for your question, first of all. And I think that the legacy of the World War II generation was very different from the legacy of the 60s generation, and in a number of respects. And in many ways, the Reverend Coffin was quite an outlier. But the I heard so many in conversations with veterans of World War II, the young second lieutenants and first lieutenants and captains who fought that war became very closely bonded with the sergeant majors and first sergeants and the rest. And so you had very, very different classes of people going into World War II, but they created lifelong bonds. And I had a friend of mine who served on the court with me, and he was in the Battle of the Bulge, and he had a first sergeant who probably saved his life. So my friend is a man of great refinement, and the first sergeant was a working class American. Every year after World War II, they got together. And you see, as much as World War II created bonds among Americans, Vietnam in the 1960s created divisions in all kinds of ways. I think the elites of the 1960s looked down their noses at the working classes and the wonderful contributions that those folks make to our society, and we cast aspersions sometime on people because their hair was too short or because they had a hard hat on, and completely overlooked all the things that they give us. And that was part of the problem. And you had it basic training, you had people coming in with college and graduate degrees, and they were being supervised and everything by sergeants who may not have graduated from high school, but instead of learning from one another, and there was a lot to learn on each side, some resentments took hold. And there was another, I think, very serious class problem that developed during the 1960s that did not develop in World War II. In World War II, everybody went. If you were physically capable, you went. And in the 1960s, people were looking for ways to get out of it. And I don't absolve myself from this. I took an honorable course. I took a lawful course. But it wasn't a particularly courageous course. And I joined the Army Reserves, which, you know, again, was lawful, but I wasn't going to be sent overseas. I wasn't going to be sent to Vietnam. So what develops here is that a lot of working class Americans went and fought that war during the time of a universal draft, and then a lot of more privileged upper middle class Americans stayed home. And so you had that you had that problem too, which was creating class divisions. So unlike World War II, all kinds of class resentments and class divisions were created during the 1960s, most specifically but not exclusively by the war in Vietnam. And then these reverberate in our political system, first in 1972 election and then in the 1980 election and most recently in the 2016 election, where we have become a nation divided by class in a way that we never were before. And what one war did to unite us, another war did and tried to undo by dividing us. So I think the situation and the legacies of the World War II generation and the legacies of the 1960s and the Vietnam War generation are as different as night and day.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me make a quick announcement about our upcoming schedule. Our next scheduled Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. It's a Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum. We'll be talking about the copyright case being argued tomorrow, Star Athletica. Today, of course, we're talking to Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson about his memoir, All Falling Faiths. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines will be wide open after this next caller. So let's move on to the next caller.
Judge, this is Vikrant Reddy calling from Washington, D.C. There's a quote from Bill Clinton, and I'm not going to get it exactly right, but I think what he said was, "Modern American politics is divided into two kinds of people. If you think that something good came out of the 60s, you're probably a Democrat. If you don't think anything good came out of the 60s, you're probably a Republican." I just wonder if you have any reflections on that quote.
Well, it's actually a very famous quote, and it's always and I'm glad you brought that up, because it's always saddened me to hear a quote repeated, and he certainly did make the statement. And the problem that I have with the quote is that it implies that these divisions are irreconcilable, and that the views we take toward the 1960s just divide us right down the middle. And that we're never gonna change, and that's part of what I did want to try to counteract, to try to at least have each side understand that there is another side of the argument. And I've been talking about all the different forms of damage the 1960s have. I have some people who see, I have some friends who see the decade quite differently, maybe the same way that President Clinton and Secretary Clinton do. But you know, they're my friends, and those who take a positive view of the 1960s, they have their strong points to make as well. And their view is that the long arc of American history really has been one of embrace and inclusion, and that the 1960s helped make us a country for all Americans, and not just some. And there's a lot of truth to that. And I don't think that ultimately that overcomes the just extraordinary damage along so many fronts and in so many ways that the 1960s inflicted. But it seems to me that, you know, we may, and maybe this hope of mine is naive, but it may be, just maybe, notwithstanding that quote that you just read to me, that that our generation of the 1960s has been given another chance. And that doesn't happen very often, but you don't get many do-overs, but, you know, it may just be that it remains our generational opportunity and in the later stages of our life to try to help bring together this country that in our youth we did so much to drive apart. And I don't know what greater gift we can give America than trying to help to heal those and to cool those boiling antagonisms before our tumultuous generation leaves Shakespeare's stage and life itself for good. And so they said, this is an impossible mission. But what other choice do we have but to try? Do we just want to continue down the road we've been traveling? Do we want to continue to have an irreconcilable difference of views that the Bill Clinton quote describes? Or do we recognize that there's a higher good which lies in a degree of mutual respect and love and patriotism for this country that people of divergent views and philosophies just might happen to share? And so the president that appointed me to the bench, Ronald Reagan, he always used to refer to America as a shining city on a hill. And people scoffed at that, and they just snickered at it, and they donned all sorts of airs of intellectual superiority and brought up the grade B actor business. And I really didn't like that at all. I thought it was a perfectly beautiful image. I thought it is right that we can be sentimental and idealistic and visionary about the greatness of America and the exceptionalism of America. And I frankly think that the 1960s did much to erode our views about the exceptionalism of America, because so much of what I heard at college had to do with a negative view toward American history and America as an oppressor nation, or a negative view toward the private sector. And the Lord knows we are not a perfect nation, but there's so much good about this country, and Ronald Reagan expressed it perhaps as few people could. And I really didn't like the kind of sort of cynicism and jaundice view that greeted our most hopeful of recent presidents.
Oh, this is Dean Reuter again. We do have two more questions pending. I'd add to that, Judge. Ronald Reagan also said that, I'm paraphrasing here, but people would go to Germany, even move to Germany or to Spain or move to Russia, but not to become Germans. They didn't become Spaniards. They didn't become Russians. But when people come to the United States, they come here to be Americans, to become Americans. And that's an interesting phenomenon, too, an interesting observation, I think, by President Reagan.
But, you know, it really is. And I just found Reagan's optimism to be so different from the negativism and the cynicism that I encountered many times in the 1960s. And so I wonder in the long run, I mean, what is going to win out? Is it going to be Reagan's message of hope and belief in the extraordinary contributions of America, not in the perfection of America by any means? We have our shameful chapters of slavery and segregation, but along with those chapters, we have this beautiful Constitution and we have this wonderful Bill of Rights that's given us freedom, and not just us freedom, but has helped to spread freedom around the globe. We have a wonderful economic system that puts value, I think, upon individual enterprise. We have an extraordinary founding generations of America, among whom are James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, that have given us these priceless Federalist Papers as some of our founding documents. And just what this country has meant for human freedom. How do we lose sight of all that with everyone being a victim? I'm sure there's some justification for it, but there's more justification to realize what there is good about America. And I say in my book that, you know, America, no, it's not a sainted nation. No, but it's not a sinning nation either. That what it is we Americans are a nation that's tried. We've tried to get this right. We don't think we're perfect, but we continue to try to move toward goals that may be unattainable ultimately, because utopias are never easy to reach. But the value lies in the striving. And America is a nation that's tried.
Once again, if you'd like to ask our author a question, Judge Harvey Wilkinson, push the star button and the pound button. We've got a couple callers with questions pending. Let's turn now to another caller.
Hi, this is John Giesman from Minnesota. I'm a law student. I just wanted to thank you for during the 60s. Thinking
you're breaking up a little bit. If you could repeat the question, please.
Oh, sorry. This is John Giesman from Minnesota. I'm a law student. I'm just wondering if Your Honor had an opinion on how the Constitution fared during the 60s. I'm thinking of the court looking to penumbras of the Constitution, but anything positive as well. I appreciate it.
Well, that's an interesting question because, I mean, I think the Constitution as a whole, in some of the decisions there, I would say that the Constitution fared pretty well, and certainly in the 1950s, Brown v. Board of Education, but there were a number of decisions in the 1960s that broke down barriers of color and segregation in buses and water fountains and movie theaters, and those fell. And then there was Gideon v. Wainwright, which in the early 1960s guaranteed a right to counsel for those accused of trial of crimes. And so there were some good decisions, particularly early on in the decade. Later on in the decade, the decisions were more and more gave, I think, sanctions to actions of civil disobedience in protest. And you want to protect everybody's right to protest, but you don't want them to be able to block streets and driveways and this and that. So you want those First Amendment values guaranteed, but you don't want violence and disruption sanctioned. And I thought that despite its early good decisions, that the court began a little bit later to tip over the line. And you get a justice like Hugo Black, who was among the court's very ardent exponents of what you might call a liberal view of the Constitution early on in his career. By the late 1960s, he became the majority's most one of the most vocal critics, for the simple reason that he felt that the court had moved from the protection of protest to the sanctioning of some law breaking. The problem was that there seemed to be this extraordinary. So the picture's mixed. In response to your question, one of the problems I found was that there seemed to be this disconnect between what was happening in the high echelons of the Supreme Court and what was actually going on in the streets. And one of the sort of juxtapositions and ironies that I thought happened was the terrible riot in Watts in Los Angeles. It took place only 3 or 4 days after the Voting Rights Act was passed and took effect. And so in an interesting way, the channels of voting and change and the arteries of change in America were being opened up, but a lot of that didn't seem to register at ground level, and it was too bad, because what happened was we lost patience with the law. The thing we expect sometimes from law is that it's going to just bring a perfect state of affairs to us tomorrow. But it doesn't work that way. The law runs a long race, but so often it's a good race. And when the law crosses the finish line on a problem or an issue, it has the potential to do so in an enduring way. And I think the problem was in part that the 1960s introduced all this impatience. That, you know, if it's not here tomorrow, and then to heck with it. You know, the law just requires a certain bit of patience, in that there are going to be two steps forward and one step back. And along with so much else that I think that may have been lost too. But at any rate, thank you for your question. It's a good one.
We do have one question pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Judge Wilkinson, it's David Emerson with the Berkeley Federalist Society. Berkeley having had a bit of a role in the 1960s, so I'm very close to the subject, and I thought a bit about myself. I'm looking forward to reading your memoir. My question has to do with, I think it's just following on a thread that you brought up about the draft during the Vietnam War and the consequences of that. And in particular, I'd like to get your thoughts on the destabilization and erosion of the principal religious denominations in the country, and how that was a consequence of the 60s. And you had talked a bit before in your own personal history about, you know, how some people served in Vietnam and some people didn't. And certainly the clergy was one place where, well, if you don't want to call them draft dodgers, certainly draft avoiders ended up. And how that has had a consequence on the religions of the, or so these mainstream religious establishments today, as kind of a foundation of what brings us together in national unity.
Well, I really hadn't touched on the subject of religious faith, but I'm glad you brought that up. And, you know, the 60s isn't the cause of everything, because causation can be very complicated. But I think the 1960s contributed to the erosion of religious faith in this way. Maybe not as substantially as Einstein and Darwin, but it worked its own impairments. I can do, you know, what I can just bring you back to my personal experience to what happened. And when I was a very young child growing up, I had this very personal view of God, and I talk about God being a figure above the cloud on a swing in purple robes, and because he was on a swing because swinging was something that anybody, even God, liked to do, and purple robes was something that God would wear because he was king. And so I, obviously, that was the view of a very young child, and it didn't, and part of this is just coming of age, irrespective of the 1960s, but God remained for me quite personal, and as I was growing up, and he visited very personal moments in my life, and maybe God was just a substitute for conscience, but whatever God was, I thought that he was a presence. And so the 1960s shook faith, I think, in a very fundamental way, and because of the vision of God, which took on very personal terms for, I think, a lot of us, suddenly everything became just totally impersonal in a way. And that's not just through the vastness of the cosmos. It's not just through a course in astronomy, because I think it's quite possible to see the rational hand of a creator in the vastness of the universe. But what I think the 60s imparted, sometimes explicitly and sometimes not, is the fact that with so much bad happening around us, how can you continue to believe in a God? How can you continue to believe in God when the Kennedys were shot and Martin Luther King was shot? How can you continue to believe in God when Biafran children starve? How can you continue to believe in God when you see the impoverishment around the major global centers and the slums in the world, or you see the riots in the country and all of the chaos and upheaval of the 1960s, which seemed random in many ways, and it seemed unfair in other ways, and it seemed inexplicable in other ways. You know, I've heard at conferences, you know, how can you reconcile all of this this damage and all of this human suffering and all of this evil? How do you reconcile that with God? And it was sometimes these things, these events were put forward as a way to leave our faith. And I don't think that was right. We all struggle with faith, and I sure did. But we became a less religious country because of the devastation and mayhem of this decade. I mean, not completely so, because thank goodness there's still such strong religious strains among us, and there's still these wonderful churches and synagogues and places of worship where people hold religious values and where religious communities help the individuals through the most difficult of times, and where faith still burns strong. But it was a decade that weakened the force of faith in our life to our great detriment, and as it did so many other institutions. And, you know, I'm really sad about it, because whatever your faith may be, whether it be Christian or Jewish or Muslim or Hindu or Buddhist or whatever, there is still a commonality to our belief, and it still seems to me to add so much to the strength of individuals and to the cohesion and mutual aid that is given within communities. So that's part of what we lost. The 60s isn't the sole cause of it, but it sure as heck was a contributing cost. And it's one of the things on which we're running a deficit today.
We do have what looks to be the final question of the day, so let's turn now to one more caller here. Got about 5 minutes left.
Hi, this is Roger Clegg at the Center for Equal Opportunity, and I'm an old friend of Judge Wilkinson's, and I wanted to call and say hello and congratulate you, Judge, on your new book. And ask you sort of a follow-up to the last question. I mean, it really seems to me that a religious person, a Christian, could take a very different view of the 60s. You know, the problem of evil, particularly, you know, human evil, is not a new one, and certainly was not new in the 20th century to the 60s. I mean, you know, what happened in Russia, what happened in Nazi Germany was, you know, much worse than anything that was going on in the United States. And those were not problems, you know, that were, you know, that can be blamed on a, I mean, they I think could be looked at as an example of what happens when societies turn from religion. And many of the heroes of the 60s, like Martin Luther King, were, I mean, this is forgotten now, but, you know, his was very much a religious message. I think that the problems of the 60s, I mean, I think there's both cause and effect there. I think a lot of the problems came from, you know, not enough Christianity, and the so that was the cause, but I agree with you that part of the effect was to further undermine people's faith. But I think that the message that I would take away anyway from the 60s was, you know, more God, not less.
Well, first of all, I want to say it's great to hear from you, Roger, and I remember serving with you in the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice in the Reagan administration, and I sure enjoyed our friendship back then, and I'm happy to regard you as a friend now. And I think you're right I never claimed that the 60s is the sole cause of something, but I do emphatically claim that the 60s exacerbated the problem in our country, because those other events that you describe about what was happening in Soviet Russia and in Nazi Germany, they were horrible, terrible beyond belief. But they didn't happen here. And what happened here was a searing experience of our own. And I think that was very hard to deal with, because it was combined with a sort of a nihilism. And one of the problems is there's all too little space for God and faith in a nihilistic nation. And the 1960s helped a little bit to push us along that path, and it's one of many things, the decade unfortunately helped to worsen. But I sure do want to thank you, Roger, for your thoughts, because they are now what they were then. Very thoughtful comments indeed.
Well, thank you so much, Judge Wilkinson. I'm a great fan of yours, and I'll just, you know, end by saying that after everyone has bought and read your book, then they can also get C.S. Lewis's book, The Problem of Pain, to get a good discussion of you know, the problem of evil and suffering in this world.
Well, we are. This is Dean Reuter. We are out of time and also out of questions. I want to give each of our guests a chance to express a final thought. Danielle Sassoon, do you want to say anything by way of wrapping up?
I'd just like to thank Judge Wilkinson for his thoughtful book and his thoughtful remarks today, and for setting a fine example for the rest of us today in how to think about approaching the challenges of today's world and how to think about engaging with other people with thoughtfulness and with integrity. So thank you, Judge.
Dean, my final thoughts just have to do with my appreciation for the Federalist Society, and it's a great organization. I've been proud to appear on its programs for many years, and very grateful to you for setting up such interesting programs and a wonderful practice group forum. And it's a great organization which fulfills a much needed place in our society and helps so much to contribute to a more worthwhile dialogue. So I'm very proud of the Federalist Society and the role that you've played in it. And it's a great pleasure to be with you today.
Thank you. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson. He's the author of, once again, All Falling Faiths, Reflections on the Promise and Failure of the 1960s. My thanks as well to Danielle Sassoon for doing the heavy lifting on the program today. And I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your thoughtful comments and questions. A reminder to our audience about our next scheduled teleforum conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.